Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present John Quigley, professor of law at Ohio State University, who examines Iraq's decision to allow the return of UN weapons inspectors in the context of the Bush administration's threat to launch a unilateral war to depose Saddam Hussein. Gordon Clark, coordinator of the Iraq Pledge of Resistance, who discusses a national movement being organized to resist a new U.S. war against Iraq. And Eric Olson of Amnesty International, who explains why human rights groups are protesting the White House certification that Colombia's military has met congressionally mandated human rights standards. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
August marked the third anniversary of Russian President Vladimir Putin's anti-terror sweep in Chechnya. An estimated 100,000 Russian army troops and police are deployed in Chechnya to tame the rebellious republic. Officially, the sweeps are performed to check identities in villages and to detain suspected rebels. Critics like Amnesty International say the sweeps result in a siege where soldiers go on a violent rampage. On May 21st, Russian troops surrounded the village of Meskhur Yurt, southeast of the capital city of Grozny. They told the village's 2,000 residents to stay inside. The soldiers then took away every male over the age of 12 for identification. The next day, many mothers gathered outside a mosque to protest the siege and demanded that any document inspection be done in full public view. The Russian soldiers complied, but later used its network of informants to identify rebel sympathizers. Later, many of those pointed out turned up dead. In mid-June, 25-year-old Adam Tamir Sultanov was found dead with his skull split open and his skin marred by cigarette burns. The district prosecutor admits that some abuses were inflicted in the sweep that killed at least 8 people. Over the last year, there has been little outcry over the Russian tactics in Chechnya. Putin joined the war on terrorism and gave the army carte blanche to crack down on the rebels. The Bush administration didn't complain until the Russians started to make incursions into neighboring Georgia. In contrast to its neighbors in southern Africa, Botswana has moved ahead on progressive land reform and avoided conflicts over the expulsion of white farmers that has gripped Robert Mugabe's Zimbabwe. Although Botswana never suffered from the concentration of land ownership in white hands that was imposed under apartheid law in South Africa and Rhodesia. According to the World Press Review magazine, nearly 80% of Botswana land is now allocated by a decentralized system of local land boards, and land is allocated for free. Still, this has not prevented Botswana from facing a housing crisis. A conflict over land has been caused by large numbers of people migrating to urban areas in search of good-paying jobs. As a result, thousands have gathered in squalid camps near major cities. Over the last year, the Botswana government has moved to demolish the squatters' homes, but this created a major backlash among civil society groups. In recent months, social activists and the government did find some common ground at a meeting sponsored by the Forum on Sustainable Agriculture. Both sides agreed on the need to preserve the rule of law and to better accommodate the needs of low-income families who want to live close to booming cities. On August 5th, President George W. Bush met with some American heroes, the Kew Creek Nine, the Pennsylvania coal miners who were trapped underground when they mistakenly drilled into an abandoned coal shaft filled with water. According to the news magazine In These Times, Bush failed to mention coal mine safety in a speech he made when he met the miners, and for good reason. Unions and other critics say the Bush administration allowed mine safety to decline by canceling new regulations and allowing the backlog of mine inspections to pile up. In 2001, 42 Americans died in coal mine accidents, and the worst accident in 20 years took place last September in Brookwood, Alabama, when 18 miners were killed. Coal mining has always been a dangerous job. But safety improved dramatically in 1969 after Congress passed the Coal Mine Safety and Health Act, and annual mine fatalities fell below 100 deaths a year. But since early 2001, the administration has tried to cut the safety budget. Now some Democrats in Congress are belatedly advocating for the restoration of funds for mine safety. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau. We'll be right back.
One day after the first anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks, President Bush made a speech at the United Nations, delivering an ultimatum to Iraq and the world that unless Baghdad immediately complied with UN resolutions, a war would be launched. On the evening of Monday, September 16th, Naji Sabri, Iraq's Minister of Foreign Affairs, sent a letter to UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, stating that the government of Saddam Hussein will now allow the return of UN weapons inspectors to Iraq without conditions. While Kofi Annan and other nations welcomed this shift in Iraq's position as a first step toward providing assurance that Baghdad no longer possesses weapons of mass destruction, the White House dismissed the Iraqi decision as a tactic that will fail. Despite the sudden turn of events, Bush administration officials continued to pressure the UN Security Council to pass a new resolution demanding Iraq's complete cooperation with inspectors, while at the same time authorizing the automatic use of force if it chose not to comply. Permanent Security Council members, France and Russia, have rejected the American approach, and Paris has offered a less bellicose set of two resolutions. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with John Quigley, professor of international law at Ohio State University, who examines Iraq's decision to allow the return of UN weapons inspectors in the context of the Bush administration's threat to launch a unilateral war to depose Saddam Hussein.
I don't think it will have any effect on the administration. I mean, the administration has already more or less rejected the offer, but I think it will make it much more difficult for the United States because it will not have as much support as it would have if Iraq were being recalcitrant about the weapons inspectors. I think that most countries are taking this very seriously. They think the United States would be very much out of line to be attacking Iraq at a time when Iraq is saying that it will deal with the primary issue.
What is critical at this point for the United Nations to do, Kofi Annan and the members of the Security Council, to avert war?
I think they need to promote the weapons inspection in a serious fashion and at the same time make it clear to the United States that that military force is not an appropriate way to deal with it. I mean, I think that latter part is a difficult thing for Kofi Annan and for the other permanent members because we have been using military force unilaterally against Iraq now all through this 10-year period, specifically through the no-fly zones, which represent a unilateral use of military force. That is, we prevent the Iraqi Air Force from overflying the bulk of the territory of Iraq. And in the last few weeks, we have much more aggressively than previously gone after the air defenses of Iraq. So we are currently attacking Iraq without any Security Council authorization.
When President Bush addressed the General Assembly of the United Nations, he stated that if the United Nations did not authorize the use of force against Iraq, that the U.S. would go it alone and act unilaterally. The White House seems to justify this on the basis of the doctrine of self-defense. What can you tell us about the legality of the Bush doctrine of preemptive strikes?
Well, there's no basis in international law for a preemptive kind of military action against another state. The only thing that's permissible is self-defense, and self-defense is permissible only if an attack is ongoing or obviously imminent, which is not the situation here. That is, you can't simply attack a state because you think that it's going to attack you in the future. And here with Iraq, by the administration's analysis, Iraq does not have access to fissionable material for a nuclear device. It would be a very substantial period of time if it were to acquire that material now before it would be capable of launching an attack. And by other means, it might be possible sooner, but you know, that's very unclear through some kind of biological technique. But the rules of international law on use of force are designed to make it difficult for states to use force by saying that they think another state is going to attack them. I mean, if you allow that, then virtually any state can attack another state that does anything at all that appears to be threatening.
If the U.S. indeed does go forward with an attack on Iraq to overthrow the government of Saddam Hussein, what kind of precedent does that set for other countries who have conflicts with each other?
I think it would be a very negative precedent. It would really mean the severe erosion of the whole concept of restraint and use of force between states and an invasion of the United Nations. It would really be another nail in the coffin of the United Nations.
John Quigley, could you assess for us the pattern of behavior we've seen by the Bush administration and the Clinton administration before it in terms of its regard or lack of regard for international treaties and conventions and working in general with other countries cooperatively?
I think it's been a rather negative record. The administration is opposed and now trying to thwart the activity of the International Criminal Court. We have not signed the Kyoto Protocol that protects against global warming. We are really putting ourselves in the category of being a kind of an outlaw.
Just a final question here, and that is, what do you think the net effect of the United States upending international laws, treaties, and conventions, the doctrine of first strike or preemptive strike, will that in the long run make Americans safer and the world more safe in your view?
I don't think it will make it safer. I think if we want to make the world safer, we need to look at some of the causes of the sentiment that is felt against the United States in the Middle East and deal with that. That would be the way to make the United States safe, not by military strikes, which are likely to have just the opposite effect and probably give birth to another generation of people who are willing to commit suicide in order to inflict harm on the United States.
That was John Quigley, professor of international law at Ohio State University. For more information, contact the National Lawyers Guild at area code 212-679-5100 or visit their website at www.nlg.org. As the Bush administration works to undercut Saddam Hussein's offer to allow U.N. weapons inspectors to return to Iraq, the Pentagon is escalating its attacks against Iraqi air defenses. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld announced on September 16th that in response to Iraqi anti-aircraft fire directed at U.S. and British warplanes patrolling northern and southern no-fly zones, he has ordered Allied jets to attack command and control sites that operate Iraq's surface-to-air missile batteries. Many observers view these changes in tactics as a means to degrade Iraq's ability to defend itself in advance of a future U.S. attack. As part of its preparation for war against Baghdad, the U.S. also recently announced that it will base B-2 bombers at a British airbase on the island of Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, 3,000 miles closer to Iraq than current bases in Missouri. In other signs that the Bush administration is laying the groundwork for war, General Tommy Franks, the commander of U.S. forces in the Persian Gulf, is planning to move key sectors of his headquarters from Tampa, Florida, to Qatar by November. As the drums of war beat ever louder, peace groups around the U.S. have responded by organizing teach-ins, protests, and vigils. One of the projects now underway, the Iraq Pledge of Resistance, is modeled on an earlier effort to stop American military intervention in Central American conflicts during the 1980s. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Gordon Clark, coordinator of the Iraq Pledge of Resistance, who discusses this national movement being organized to oppose a new U.S. war against Iraq.
It's called the Iraq Pledge of Resistance, and it is very much modeled after the Central America Pledge of Resistance, which effectively mobilized public opposition against Reagan administration policies in Central America, specifically preventing an invasion of Nicaragua or El Salvador. This one, of course, is focused on the impending war with Iraq, and there are a number of national organizations, including Peace Action, Pax Christi USA, Fellowship of Reconciliation, Voices in the Wilderness, and others who are joining together to organize this campaign. And specifically what the Pledge of Resistance is mass, nationally coordinated, nonviolent civil disobedience. It is an effort by those of us who are truly concerned about this impending war in Iraq, its effects primarily on the people of Iraq, but also on the people of the United States and a myriad of foreign policy concerns that will be affected by such an attack. It is the strongest way that we can withdraw our support, publicly withdraw our support from the Bush administration and do whatever we can to stop it by literally putting our bodies on the line. And our freedom for many of us for the amount of time that we will spend in jail for performing these actions. The Iraq Pledge of Resistance is being organized in a number of cities around the country. That list is growing. We have high hopes that we will soon be able to make it an international Pledge of Resistance, although we're focusing on the United States at the moment. It's a very active campaign right now, and I think over the coming weeks we are going to see numerous cities organizing to oppose the Bush policy in Iraq in the most rigorous way possible, once again putting our bodies on the line as necessary.
Gordon, give us your overall assessment of where the Bush administration is taking this country and the world in its drive for war against Iraq.
Well, I think with the Bush administration, we are seeing the fullest expression of the hegemony that the United States has held, the Pax Americana, if you will, except there's not too much Pax involved, since the end of the Cold War. You know, many people ask why Bush is so intent on doing this, and while there are a number of different reasons, and I think certainly the current push, like a decision must be made right now, it certainly has to do with the midterm elections and the White House's attempts to influence them by making people think about military actions as opposed to the woes of the domestic economy or corporate scandals. But overall, I think what we're looking at is an administration that came in and has basically been suckered by the temptation of dominion. And that's something for those in your audience who are Christians, but it's an important example. Dominion was actually the third temptation reportedly offered to Christ, that he would have rule over all the earth. And it's ironic that this president, who calls himself a follower of Jesus Christ, has in fact succumbed to the temptation of dominion and believing that basically because no one can stop the United States from doing what it wants, that the United States is therefore free to do anything that it wants anywhere in the world. You know, we've certainly seen that in terms of the repudiation of all the specific treaties, be they environmental or weapons related. And I think we are seeing that now in respect to war, that, you know, as he said to the UN, the Bush administration's concept of consulting is basically, here's what we're going to do. Please agree with us or get out of the way.
Gordon Clark, the Bush administration's rationale that we must attack Iraq, eliminate Saddam Hussein in order to prevent future terrorist attacks on the United States, such as September 11th, resonates with many people in this country. Have the American people, in your view, bought this claim that war with Iraq is necessary?
Well, you know, living near Washington, D.C., and being involved in politically, you know, new polls come out every day. Polls can swing 10 or 20 points based on what happened the day before. They can swing 20 or 30 points based on how the question is worded. And when you ask Americans, for instance, is getting rid of Saddam a good idea? Well, of course they're going to say yes. Then if you start adding things like, well, what if no one in the rest of the world supports this? Then you see support plummet. Well, what if it involves a number or heavy U.S. casualties? Then you see support plummet once again. So I think on a very simple level, a very surface level, which is frankly the level that many poll questions are asked on a very surface level, people say yes, sure. But as soon as you start talking about the likely consequences of war, of what might happen to the U.S., then you see support plummet. And that's why I think it's in the interest of certainly the Bush administration, many people, to keep it on this very, very shallow, simple level of, like, Saddam's a bad man, we have to get rid of him. Saddam is a bad man. So is Pervez Musharraf, you know, the self-appointed president for life of Pakistan, who's receiving U.S. aid at the same time he clamps down on any sort of democratic resistance in his own country. The Saudi royal family are bad people who, although it's not discussed much in the media, run one of the most repressive religious regimes in the Middle East. In fact, they have religious police who are just about as bad as the Taliban were before they were kicked out of power. So the question is not, is Saddam Hussein a bad man? Of course he is. The question is he an imminent or grave threat to the United States? And I think the answer is absolutely not. And the other question is, will this make the Middle East or the world better by us going in militarily to take him out? And again, I say the answer is absolutely not. It will make any number of things much, much worse and risks catastrophic consequences.
That was Gordon Clark, coordinator of the Iraq Pledge of Resistance. The group can be contacted by calling area code 301-608-2450 or visit their website at www.peacepledge.org. On September 9th, the Bush administration released $42 million in military aid to the Colombian government after certifying human rights there had improved enough to meet a congressional requirement. Factions, including leftist guerrillas, the military, and police, have been waging war in Colombia for almost four decades, joined in recent years by right-wing paramilitaries blamed for an increasing share of human rights violations. Amnesty International estimates that there are 4,000 politically related killings annually in Colombia, with the number likely to go higher this year. Gross human rights violations, including massacres, extrajudicial executions, torture, disappearances, and massive displacement of populations, have all continued. Amnesty has protested the most recent White House certification that human rights in Colombia are being respected, as it has in all past certifications. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Eric Olson, Amnesty International's Advocacy Director for the Americas, about what he views as a flawed certification process and how the war is impacting Colombians.
So far, they've gone ahead and certified, despite our vehement objections and all the evidence to the contrary. It's been a very frustrating process, and it almost rendered the law meaningless anyway.
And now with a new president, Uribe was recently elected, and his whole campaign was to basically wipe out the guerrillas, is my understanding. I've been reading a couple of things very recently that since he was inaugurated, there's been even closer and more documented cooperation between the military of Colombia and the paramilitaries. Does Amnesty have a position on that? Do you think that that is in fact the case?
Well, he's only been in office for a month, so I don't know that it's more or worse than in the past, but we have, you're right, documented extensively existence of cooperation between the military and paramilitary forces. We have given to the State Department this week a report that names and suggests people that should be investigated and brought to justice for cooperation, a whole number of senior military officers. Those officers continue to, in many cases, either operate on active duty or on active duty in the military or have gone on to join the paramilitaries directly and have not been detained or prosecuted. So the record is pretty lousy, pretty terrible, and we see no evidence of President Uribe taking aggressive steps to sever those ties and bring people to justice. In fact, just the opposite. His attorney general's office is going through major overhaul and paying much less attention to the human rights cases.
I know that trade unionists face especially brutal repression in Colombia, and I've heard the statistic over the last few years, I guess, that half the union activists killed around the world are killed in Colombia. And are there other sectors that are at high risk as well?
It is true that labor leaders have been some of the most targeted people in Colombia. Other groups have been targeted as well. I mean, human rights defenders themselves have been targeted in many occasions, and many have died at the hands of either the military or paramilitary forces, and some obviously at the hands of the armed guerrillas as well. Other groups that have targeted are local organizations, feminist groups, local organizations that seek to be independent, church groups that try to provide humanitarian assistance in areas of conflict. Organizations of Afro-Colombians on the Atlantic coast have often been targeted. Anybody that seems to be a local organization and leader with some degree of autonomy has often been targeted.
Colombia is a pretty big country, and I wondered, are there particular areas of Colombia where human rights are denied more than in others?
It's widespread throughout Colombia, although there are clearly areas that are more dangerous than others. I mean, as a general rule, you could say that the rural areas are much more conflicted and dangerous than the urban areas. But as a general rule, the concentration has been in the south. That's where the focus of the U.S. effort has been, in the areas near the border with Ecuador and Peru. In the east, in the border areas closer to Venezuela, and then on the Atlantic coast area, where there's a large Afro-Colombian population.
What do you think it would take to improve the human rights record in Colombia, vis-a-vis especially this huge influx of military aid from the U.S.?
Well, there's an idealistic, you know, response and a practical response. I mean, I think the idealistic response, which I endorse wholeheartedly, is that the government decide to make human rights central to its governing platform and really implement a policy of first protecting human rights, and that they understand that a human rights policy leads to greater security and peace for the country and is not a threat to peace and security, as they often believe. I think from a pragmatic point of view, In our opinion, without some real serious reform and investment in the Attorney General's office and strengthening the Human Rights Office and strengthening the prosecutors who investigate and bring cases before the courts related to the military and other human rights abusers, I think that has got to be the starting point for reform, not more military, not more violence that's uncontrolled, but really a focus on building a rule of law and building the institution of the Attorney General's office.
That was Eric Olson of Amnesty International. Contact Amnesty by calling area code 202-544-0200 or visit their website at www.amnestyinternational.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikita. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Sasha Summer Cousineau, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.